This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello, and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. Now, to be honest, this is not the midweek podcast which we originally intended bringing you. But I learned at the weekend there that one of Scotland's leading, one of the most preeminent polar explorers and adventurers, Myrtle Simpson, had just celebrated her 90th birthday, and it put me in mind of an extended interview which Helen Needham and I did with her back in 2016. She is an extraordinary woman. I hope you enjoy it.
To be a polar explorer, you don't need great keep-fit muscles. It's all in the mind. And once you've got your anorak hood on, and pulling the sledge like that. That was crossing Greenland, actually. That's the day the sun came back, that magic day. Once the sun came back, you know, there's a reason for going, but up until then it had been dark, and you put your anorak hood on, and you can't communicate with you're on your own. Mm-hmm. It's not keep fit muscles from the gym. It's good old-fashioned women's stuff of slogging on.
Now, for the next half hour, Helen and I are going to be talking to somebody pretty remarkable. She was a mountaineer, a canoeist, the first woman to ski across the Greenland ice cap, has been variously referred to as a tough cookie and the mother of Scottish skiing. And she was recently awarded the Polar Medal by the Queen.
The thing that I love about this woman is that she managed to achieve all these things whilst raising four children.
Her name is Myrtle Simpson. She was born in India, an army brat. She was educated in the UK, trained as a radiographer, and by a happy chance, her first real job just happened to be in the outdoor capital of the UK.
My first job was in Fort William. Magic time in Fort William, because the surgeon, there was only one surgeon in the hospital, one doctor, in fact, called Duff. And I don't know if that name means anything to you, but he invented...
Well, the mountain rescue team leader.
Exactly. He invented mountain rescue. And he was actually a brain surgeon from Wales, but his life had gone, fallen a bit, so he got this job in Fort William. So he was, you know, absolutely perfect for me to be working with. In fact, if it was a good day, he'd close the hospital and he and I would go off and up Pollew, where, you know, the rocks to climb on and so on. And because I was working for him, I was sort of accepted by the local climbers, who, you know, I'm talking about the 1950s, were not keen on girls getting involved, but they took me on okay, although they're dying off now quite quickly. Those have been my friends ever since.
But you must have been, even from the beginning, pretty good, because, I mean, these guys cut nobody any slack.
No, you could
either do it or you couldn't.
But, I mean, it's the old story. You don't need brawn and muscle. It's, you know, it's all in the mind and that sort of thing. So girls can do it as well as guys, mm-hmm. as they're proving nowadays, but they haven't had much of a chance up till now.
So you became one of the founder team members of the Lochaber Mountain Rescue
Team. I wouldn't like to say that, because they're very proud of their... They didn't actually have teams in those days. Uh-huh. But Ian Duff knew that there was a better way to carry someone off the hill than on an old-fashioned thing. So he invented the Duff stretcher, which is what they still use.
When did you start guiding?
Oh, that's because I needed money in Fort William. And, I mean, that wasn't organised. But I found that people would pay me to take them up the hill. I mean, there were a lot of people, you know, came to Fort William and they thought, oh, I'll climb Ben Nevis. And they thought it was boring to slog up the track. So here was somebody that would actually lead them up Tower Ridge. So I used to get 10 bob for taking somebody up Tower Ridge, and I've still got some of the letters.
Were you the only female doing guiding like that?
I can't remember any girls. Well, there was the Ladies Scottish Climbing Club, which has been going for yonks, but there weren't any other girls in Fort William, and I was just very lucky. I mean, there were plenty of girlfriends who cooked the bacon in the...
But they didn't go up the hills.
They didn't actually... They didn't seem to want to go up the hills. I'm always amazed that, I mean, this was long after the suffragettes and all that stuff, but there seemed to be girls that were quite happy not to go.
So you were climbing, scrambling all over Scotland. How do you make the jump from that to catching a boat to Peru and climbing? I mean, that's in a different league.
Oh, well, that was just a bit later. You know all the story about the Craig Dhu, you know, where they came from the shipyards and they discovered the mountains.
Can you explain the Craig Dhu?
There was a gang of shipyard workers. Often their dads had discovered the great outdoors, coming out of Glasgow, and motorbikes were really their means of transport, and they'd go and they'd all camp together and then started climbing. And, of course, they were usually very good at climbing because they'd got good strong arms and dainty feet for working on in the yards and one thing and another. But they were tough guys, but some of them had come to Fort William or else climbed with the people in Fort William. And I began to hear that there were higher mountains you could go to. It was just the beginning of the post-war rush to the Himalayas, but you could go to other mountain areas and you didn't have to pay and get permission. For instance, you could go to New Zealand for a start. So I thought that was quite a good idea. So I emigrated to New Zealand for £7. You know how they talk about the £7 poms?
Well, the £10 poms, that's it, yeah.
Well, it was £7 for New Zealand. Well, you had to have a 3-year contract. Mm-hmm. And I actually saw my contract through. None of them did. But they came and worked in the freezing yard. I worked at Invercargill, that's the very bottom. Uh-huh. And it was just fantastic because although everybody knows about Hillary, there were very, very few other New Zealand climbers. And we could go at weekends and climb Virgin Peaks just in the hills, not all that far out of Invercargill. And I'd got people to climb with because we'd all gone out in the boat together. And we could do well in these hills because coming from Scotland, we knew about cutting steps.
Yes.
So we could go zinc, zinc, zinc. You became a dab hand if you were from Scotland.
With an ice axe.
With an ice axe, cutting steps. So you could make a traverse up a hill, you know, and they'd be absolutely gobsmacked.
We'd better get a job. We had.
Particularly it's going to be snow.
It does kind of look a bit rough.
Oh, it is snow, look.
Yes.
That's good news.
Yeah.
We usually have a couple of weeks where we can put our skis on in the garage there and ski here.
It's got a real, your house has got a real feeling of an alpine hut.
Well, as I say, it was a ruin.
Uh-huh.
So we knew exactly what we wanted to do with it. You know, most people who sort of do up ruins, but that, it's raining.
Well, you're still smiling.
This I love. You've got effectively a cabinet of curiosities here.
Well, that's exactly what it is. We had an RSPB person in here and they looked and they said, that's not a sea eagle's feather, is it? And I said, yes, it is actually. They said, oh, where did you get it? Where did you get it? And I said, well, we ate it actually.
Where did you eat a sea eagle?
It was in Greenland and the Greenlanders shoot everything. Uh-huh. And they eat anything.
Uh-huh.
And they just throw them onto the fire and then pull the feathers out.
What did sea eagle taste like?
Fishy. When I came back from New Zealand, and I had a good friend called Billy Wallace and I, and a lot of our friends were going to the Himalayas at that time, and we thought, you've got to pay, you know, difficult. What about Peru? And Hugh had been in the Antarctic for 3 years. Yes. Hugh said he'd get off the boat on the way back from the Antarctic and meet us in Lima. So we had to have a title, so we called ourselves the Edinburgh Peruvian Expedition. We had a great send-off. And I'd sold the rights to the Edinburgh Evening Times and I was going to, you know, we got hard cash. We wrote to the Mount Everest Foundation, who'd got a fund that you could approach for money if you'd got a good idea. So we got money, bought our tickets and set off another 6 weeks in the boat and met Hugh in Peru. And we decided what mountain we wanted to climb. It was the only one we really knew the name of, and we didn't have any maps or anything. And you can still do that, Peru, and I'm dumbfounded that so many people go to the Himalayas, which are very difficult to get permission, and you've got to know about this, that. You can still go wandering around Peru.
Did you know Hugh well before that? I'm just trying to figure out...
I knew him quite well. He'd come on my bus because the medics had to work on a Saturday morning.
So when he said, I'll meet you in Lima, that didn't sound unreasonable to you?
No. And anyway, so the three of us, you know, set off and climbed our mountain. It was just magic. Have you been to Peru? You see,
I have, yeah.
Well, you can get a train from Lima, and it gets you up into the equivalent of one of the trekking towns in Nepal. There's not miles and miles of foothills and one thing and another. And then you can get a donkey to take your luggage quite easily. And endless mountains, glorious weather, and it's just not the distances. Anyway, we were just, actually, it was the end of our time and we got a week left and we saw the highest mountain still looking at us called the Huascarán. We have a picture of it round. I think it's still hanging here. Yeah, that's it. That's the highest mountain in Peru. It's 22,000 feet and it's called the Huascarán. And it had been climbed, and funnily enough, the first person to climb it was an American woman called Annie S. Peck. Anyway, we wanted to have a go, and the quickest route for us was to go from the right, mm-hmm. up that slope, you can mm-hmm. see,
yeah.
and then onto the summit. And there's a picture in the kitchen of our highest camp. And the reason I'm struggling in that picture is I couldn't get my crampons off. And we only had one sleeping bag because it was cold and yeah. it much warmer. That's what Nansen did. He used to travel with one sleeping bag, with all his crew in one sleeping bag. Anyway, so the two boys had to sleep with me and my crampons.
You slept with the crampons on?
With the crampons on, I couldn't get them off. Anyway.
How had they frozen on, or just the leather had got hard?
I think the leather had got hard. We didn't use crampons in Scotland at the time. It was considered non-you. Nowadays, you know, I've got granddaughters at uni and climbing like that, and they've all got crampons. Well, in for a dig to have crampons in my day.
So you just,
didn't
trudged.
Do that. Well, you had nails were coming in, mm-hmm. Drakuni nails. But rubber boots, you know, rubber bites mm-hmm. on back on, they didn't hit Scotland until the 1960s.
How long have you and Hugh been married?
We got married in 1959. 59, I was trying to do the arithmetic 50, the other 50, day.
58 years then. 58 years this year it will be.
Is it? Oh, yeah. Great. I might get some prezzies.
58 years this year, and that's a relationship that was founded on you sleeping together while you were wearing crampons.
You could say that.
With another person there.
With Billy. With Billy Wallace there as well.
How do you jump from New Zealand to Peru to actually doing polar expeditions?
Well, Hugh and I got married very soon after we came back from Peru, and He didn't actually have a job because he was writing up his thesis. When he'd been in the Antarctic, he went there as a medic, mm-hmm. but he was doing his research. He was very interested in hormones that change under stress, and it was the beginning of people getting interested in that. And he got some money from NASA, it was space stuff, what would happen when people had to live on a different length day. And Hugh mm-hmm. said he could find out the answer by taking a party to the Arctic, where it was dark 6 months, light 6 months, and see how their bodies changed to this. So he'd fixed up, well, we'd both fixed up, that we'd go to Spitsbergen, Svalbard. That's an island mm-hmm. north of Norway, and he could camp there. And William Spears Bruce had a hut there. Mm-hmm. There was a Scottish expedition looking for coal
oh, right.
in the 1930s, and he left his hut. Uh-huh. So we got permission to use the hut, and then I found it was Preggers. Uh-huh. And I was far too selfish to say, oh, darling, you go away, I'll stay at home. And because I'd been
This is music to Helen's ears. You two are kindred spirits.
Well, Helen, I knew from my father being in the army, and also my grandparents had all worked in India, all that Raj stuff, the women and children went too. It was normal. It was just what you did. So it didn't really occur to me. I never thought I'll stay at home. I just did what I thought women and children, we went, I said I'd go too. So our baby was just 6 weeks when we went to Svalbard.
So was your baby born here?
Yes. And I knew that
not
the Laps... I knew that the Lapland people, the Laps, mm-hmm. they don't stop. They, you know, they have to move with the reindeer. Uh-huh. And so what do they do when they have babies? Well, of course, they move along too. I had the baby in a rucksack, and the first village we came to, all the women gathered round while I dug in and pulled out my baby, and they look of horror on their faces, and they rushed and brought a kumsa, which looks like a cradle. We have mm-hmm. it upstairs, and I've just got it back from a current baby. And it's made of birch wood, and it sits on the sledge or in a kayak, as we found, and it's all snug, and it has a little thing over the top with a bit of material, so they go out in the snow or the blizzards, and they just put the baby down in its kumsa.
When you were travelling with I take it was your son, Robin.
Yes,
was it? Right.
That's our oldest son, yes.
Well, was there anybody else there to look after him?
Yes, Hugh had taken, he needed 12 guinea pigs for his research. And so it was all climbing friends, and we said, if you'll stay at base camp for, I think it was 6 weeks, then we'll go and climb the mountains. And there's a range of mountains called the Planet Range in Spitsbergen, which still has... That's the Planet Range. That's in Svalbard.
That's beautiful.
And a lot of those peaks hadn't been climbed. Anyway, so the time came after we'd had the 6 weeks. It was just absolutely magic because we saw the spring in, and you don't often get a chance to be in the high Arctic and see the, you know, the spring in like that. And then the boys went off to climb, and I had a friend came out and joined me, Sylvan Graham, she was called, and we found that the kumsa sat very neatly in the front of our canoe. So, you know, we had a fantastic time when the boys went away, just camping along the coast, drifting along.
This is a flat expanse of snow, which is
high,
which
it's
is
high up. It's
high
a
up. So it's blue, and you can see there's one sled and ski tracks on either side, etc. There is on the horizon this pure white band of haze, then dark blue sky behind that, and just keeking out from the end of the haze, you've got the mountains. It's beautiful.
When Sylvan and I were camping on a beach, we were absolutely gobsmacked to see a big boat appeared. Mm-hmm. And out of it came lots of little buzzing boats and a very cross man. "What are you doing here?" he said to us. We said, "Well, camping."
Looking after the baby.
And he said, "Don't you know this is the International Geophysical Year and I am the senior man from Oxford and this is my territory? What are you doing here? And I've got a boat full of international geophysicists, and I've told them it's very, very dangerous and they've got to keep close by. And we found a woman and a baby." And so anyway, we said, "Well, what are you doing here?" And he said, "To look at the dinosaur footprints." And of course, we hadn't noticed that behind where we were camping up the cliff there are these footprints, and they'd come to see this unique thing on the Spitsbergen Breach.
It's about, what, 7 or 8 years ago, we were in Greenland doing a programme across there, and we took a big Tonka toy up onto, I think it was Point 59 it was called. It's quite high up, but you were just at the edge of the Greenland ice shelf. There's just this sheet of blue ice, I mean, as in a wall of blue ice, heading off into infinity in both directions. Mm. It was one of the most beautiful things I have ever seen. But you skied across that.
Yeah, but as you said, if people say to me, "Why did you do that?" You've just said why. It's magic. If you've seen it, you want to go onto it. Did you not feel you wanted to get some skis and get cracking? Uh-huh.
And I'm a rubbish skier, but I mean, I mean, really. Oh,
but
come on, you can
travel.
Be.
But you know, people expect a good skier to go zinc, zinc, zinc down the hill. Skiing to me is a means of travel.
Mm-hmm. But crossing Greenland, how many people were? How many were on that trip?
Four.
You were the first woman, though.
Yes.
That skied across Greenland.
Yes. When Nansen skied across Greenland in 1862, I think it was, they still thought there'd be green pastures in the middle. Mm-hmm. You know, the place wasn't known at all. I first saw it from Iceland. After we'd come back from Spitsbergen and had more kids and one thing and another, I didn't want to go to down the Clyde for my summer holes. Mm-hmm. So we went to Iceland. You could get to Iceland very cheaply from Glasgow. He was working at Glasgow Uni. There was a cheap flight to America, and it stopped in Reykjavik to refuel. So you could get to Iceland very cheaply from Glasgow. There's a horn of Iceland that sticks out on the left-hand side. And from there, I remember seeing across the sea, I could see the ice cap glittering. Well, as I'm sure you would have done, you thought, "Gosh, I want to go there." So that's what we did. And Hugh was still on his research, doing the same research he'd got interested in about how bodies react to, you know, do our hormones say, "Oh, danger's coming, give another pep," or whatever. So with Billy Wallace, a friend that had come on my bus and had come to...
Three in a bed with crampons.
Exactly. But we also needed, what was very important, was to get somebody who was a navigator. Because in Greenland, because it's high up, you have to take a sextant. You can't take... Your compass is no good because it's just wobbling. You're too near the North Pole. You're
massive
high up.
The deviation.
And there's no maps. So Roger was a dab hand. He was a very keen sailor, so he knew about sextants. And the early sailors navigated with sextants. So we set off. And all Roger needed was the time and his sextant. So we had to have a little radio with us. And we'd cash in at 12 o'clock midday, absolutely on the spot. The problem is you're going across Greenland, one side to the other. We wanted to go in Nansen steps. And the whole point was, at that time, people were beginning to go on what they called expeditions. And there were expeditions to everywhere. And that meant a bus or a cruise ship or something like that. And we thought, that's not right. I wonder if we're good enough to do it in the old way, like Nansen and, you know, the proper explorers. So we decided not to have any backup or anything. But we did need our sextant and our radio. Anyway, we found that we couldn't go Nansen's footsteps because the ice had changed. And our boat, we chartered a little boat from Amarsalik, which is the island on the right-hand side, the easterly side. It couldn't get into the land. It had to go further and further north. And then it couldn't get any further anyway. And he said, we'll have to chuck it, you know, go back. And we thought, if we go back, we'll never get another chance. So we thought, if the boat can't break it, our weight won't break it. So we actually got off the boat on the ice. And then we couldn't get ashore because there was water and all the rest of it. So we didn't start from where we...
Had the boat gone by that stage?
Yes. We knew that was our last...
You kind of committed to that.
Absolutely committed. Yes. And Nansen says this. He went from east to west because of that, because everybody lives on the west, apart from very few communities on the other side. The west is where the tundra is and so on. And so he knew he'd have to get there, and so would his rather motley gang of people that he took with him. If they knew that they had to get to the far end, they'd do it. And we felt rather the same, that, you know, we were really committed to getting there, and that's the best thing, to only look ahead. Anyway, we eventually got to the land, and the problem was getting through the mountains. You know the old hymn, Greenland's Icy Mountains? Well, you've got to get through all of those. And then you get to the ice cap. And once you're on the ice cap, of course, it's just absolutely glorious. The best sort of Scottish Easter frosty day, the sun just coming up. And we thought, of course, we'd probably do about 10 to 15 miles a day. The first week, I think we did half a mile the first day, perhaps 3 miles the next day. Anyway, eventually, we got to the middle. And Roger, looking at his sextant, said, it'll all change tomorrow because I know we're on the right bit, the col in the middle, and it's downhill all the way home. So the next day, Roger produced a sail out of his pocket. We hadn't believed in this, so we hadn't taken a sail. Anyway, and he fixed it on the canoe, and sure enough, the wind got in. And Nansen describes this, that he sat back to admire his sail and his sledge, and the sledge went off, and he could had to fiddle with his skis to catch up. Anyway, then it was just terrific going down, you know, downhill. But
that's my lunch. Wait.
Exactly, and my sleeping bag, which is more important. You have to make this decision before you go. You know there's going to be a melt. So do you want to go early in the year when it'll be frozen, or do you want to go late in the year when it's warmer? We thought we got it right, but in fact the melt hit us over about 50 miles out from the west coast. And then suddenly you're on a quagmire. You couldn't put the tent up and get in. You had to crawl in to get your weight over. Otherwise, you sank. And then there was one of those miracles. We woke up one morning and there'd been a night frost and it was fairyland.
Everything covered in crystals.
Exactly. And I think we made 25 miles that day. And it was just terrific.
I can remember one early morning in Greenland, and it was absolutely flat calm, probably about minus 20, minus 25, something like that. And it was snowing gently, and as the snowflakes fell, they were just scintillating coming down the air, and it was catching the sunlight, and it was as if someone was very slowly throwing handfuls of glitter through the sky.
And coloured.
Yes.
As it hit the ground, it would be coloured, and it was like an opal. You know how you change it in the sun, the different colours come up. It was just absolutely out of this world.
Yeah.
And then we'd see the mountains of the west coast, and then boys would say to me, no, you got it wrong. Look, they've moved. It's a cloud. Anyway, one day I was sure I'd stood looking at it, and it didn't move, and I was right. But by this time, all the ice that's hitting those mountains gets thrown up into great hummocks. And the sledge went clattering down one of them and bust. So we decided that Billy and I would walk, because it's rather like reaching the west coast in Scotland. Which side of the loch are you? Mm. And we weren't sure whether we were going for 3 days or whatever. And we walked and we walked and we walked, and suddenly there was purple sacks of frayed grain. Mm. And we threw ourselves down on it, and I think Billy actually ate it. You know, it was just fantastic to be on the green. But we still had to go back and get the others. And on the way back, well, we came across them in the end. We wondered why they hadn't met us by this time, the other two. And we could see they were very busy, and there were little things on the snow. And when we got closer, it was hundreds and hundreds of beer cans. We had no idea. We just tried some, and they were good. But then we found, in fact, there was one of these early warning system American bases. And their freezer had died, and somebody had said condemned everything in it, including all this beer. So they'd thrown it into the sea, and the Greenlanders had started fishing it out. And so horror from the, you know, international preservation or whatever, they said the Americans had to pick them all up again, and they ditched them on the ice cap, not knowing that we'd be passing by.
So you had a nice chilled beer.
Absolutely.
The United States Air Force.
Absolutely. Anyway, the kids then, well, we got out, went down to Sondrestrom, which is the airport, and we got a free passage for the, we had three children at the time, to come and join us. And I went to join an Inuit, well, I went to an Inuit summer camping ground where they came to get all their fish and stuff. The kids had brought in canoes, so the boys then canoed out to the coast. But I didn't do that. I went to this glen and collected plants for the Edinburgh Botanic Gardens with the children. And that's where we got a lot of those toys and stuff, because the locals, because if you travel with kids, you're everybody's friend. Perhaps
Helen's,
not nowadays,
but they were, she's done
well,
that.
In those days, you, anyway, they knew that you weren't out to get them or to tell them they were wrong, or to, you know, politicians didn't travel with kids, but I travel with these kids. And I've got magic pictures of our daughter, Rena, who was, I think, perhaps five at the time. And she made great pals with this equivalent girl, and they didn't speak a word of each other's language at the beginning of the summer holidays, and they didn't speak a word of each other's language at the end of the summer holidays, but they'd never stop playing together.
Mm-hmm. Never stop talking, anyway.
Never, exactly.
Yeah.
How long did you leave the children for when you went off to Greenland then?
And that was a month, 32 days it took us to cross.
But nobody had any idea how long it would take then?
Well, we knew how long it had taken Nansen. So we'd reckoned it would be, you know, about the same. And it's another story, but they actually came with a friend of mine, and we collected the plants and amalgamated with this family. And then the boys eventually arrived back.
Did you ever feel guilty about leaving your children for, say, a month whilst you went off exploring?
I didn't want to leave them. That's why they were coming to join me. But you wouldn't take kids across the ice cap. You know, I mean, we'd had looked into the dangers, and you wouldn't do that. But I thought it would be great for them to have the opportunity to get to know an Inuit family and stay. Well, what fun it would be.
Were all the summer holidays for your kids like that? I mean, did any stage did they turn around and say, please, can we go to Rothsay,
yes, somebody
Marbella,
told me recently. Like, well, somebody told me recently they met my boy Robin when we were slogging up the hill in Glencoe. Uh-huh. And they said, and Robin said, it's my birthday today. And they said, what did you get for your present? And he said, I didn't get it. It was so that we didn't need to go up the hill today.
Ungrateful little wretch.
Yes.
And what are they like now? Are they into the outdoors?
They are, actually. People said, oh, there'd be drink, drugs and disaster. But in fact, they've all followed what we have done. Their kids, our grandchildren, are all into climbing or kayaking and stuff.
Is there one place on the planet that you haven't been that you'd really regret not having gone?
Oh, yes. Oh, there's masses of them. I'd love to climb in the Pamirs. I'd love to go to the Russian Arctic. Now, in our day, you couldn't get near the Russian Arctic, but now you can't get near lots of the Arctic I've been in, but you can. I mean, there's some magic settlements still of, I think because it was left alone so much, in the Russian Arctic, particularly when you get round the corner heading for Japan and so on, with communities, you know, living like Nansen found Greenland families and so on. You know, they're still there, completely untrackled with and so on, and I'd love to have had a chance to go there.
I was talking to somebody quite recently, and they said that we tend to regret what we haven't done, not what we have done.
Oh, of course you do. I think everybody is born with, or all children are born with, they want to get to over the horizon. You know, if you put a toddler there, he'll go straight to the window, crawling, or you know, they want to get over there, and then a lot of people lose that. But I think if you've wanted to get over the horizon and see what's down the far side, of course you regret the places you haven't been to.
The extraordinary Myrtle Simpson there, and from all of the Scotland Outdoors team, Myrtle, a very happy birthday to you. I hope you have many more of the same. I'm Mark Stephen. This has been the Scotland Outdoors Podcast. From all of the team, thanks for listening.